warm greetings and Happy New Year. Shortly, we will be showing you a PowerPoint presentation of Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center. The establishment of the Meditation Retreat Center is a long-held aim of Venerable Achan Brahm and the Buddhist Society of Western Australia. It is a logical step in the development of the meditation retreat facilities and the fostering of Buddhism in the wider community. The overall aim of the Meditation Retreat Center is to provide people with an opportunity to develop samadhi, states of peace, calm, and clarity, and vipassana, insight into truth. The vision of the Meditation Retreat Center in Australia, Perth, first is to foster retreat participants in their meditation practice and their path to deep meditation. Two, to make retreats more affordable and accessible to a wider Buddhist community by charging only an amount necessary to maintain the upkeep of the center. Three, to provide and maintain a peaceful meditative atmosphere for meditators and followers of 8 precepts during their stay. Fourthly, to become a center for teaching and practicing that is suitable for monks and lay people, the healthy and infirm, the young and old. Land for this project has already been kindly donated. Nestled among tall stands of Jarrah forest in the tranquil surrounds of Serpentine, the proposed meditation retreat center is just 1 hour's drive south of Perth and is practically across the road from Bodhiyana Monastery. I will let the PowerPoint presentation take you through the details of the project. Ladies and gentlemen, may I present to you Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center project.
The Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center, a project for the benefit of all humanity to cultivate peace, calm and clarity, to develop insight into truth and reality.
The Meditation Retreat Center is a long-held vision of Ajahn Brahmavamsa. Most of you would probably be familiar with this very popular monk and teacher who has been coming to Malaysia for the last 8 years or so. When Ajahn Brahmavamsa gives Dharma talks and conduct meditation retreats, it is typically to full house capacity crowds.
The purpose of this Meditation Retreat Center is to promote the practice of meditation, to make retreats affordable and accessible, and to provide peaceful meditative atmosphere that is conducive even for the old and infirmed.
The place is designed to accommodate 60 meditators comfortably. There are to be 10 chalets of houses arranged in a ring. Each of them has 6 single rooms, and each room comes with attached bathroom and hot water showers.
There are covered walkways connecting the 10 houses to the 2 main buildings in the center. Nearer to the main entrance is the kitchen and dining room, which also serves as the administrative center.
And right at the heart of the retreat center is a large meditation hall. This hall is surrounded by rooms designed for walking meditation practice.
The architect for this retreat center was chosen specifically because of his good work in designing buildings and facilities for the old and infirmed. The entire complex will be made wheelchair friendly. Set amongst lush greenery and temperate Perth climate, the environment here is favourable for retreats all year round.
Considering that retreats conducted by Ajahn Brahm are typically fully booked, one can imagine the number of people who will benefit from this retreat centre, and amount of good that will be generated towards well-being of mankind. It is envisioned that this place will be funded only through goodwill and donations.
To give you an idea of where the project is at, let's take a quick tour starting from a familiar landmark, the KLCC. If we flew to the southeastern direction, just over the horizon, we will come to the world's largest island, which is the island of Australia.
At the southwestern corner of this island is the city Perth. Those of you who have been there would be familiar with its pleasant moderate climate.
Travelling 30 kilometres, or about an hour's drive to the south, we come to the town of Serpentine.
Another 5 kilometres south again, just off the main highway, is a place known affectionately as the Monk Factory.
This is the Bodhiyana Monastery, where Ajahn Brahmavamsa is the abbot. There are typically 20 monks in residence here, training under Ajahn Brahmavamsa, in very basic and austere conditions.
Yet, there is also a waiting list of over 100 aspiring monks who want to be trained here.
Moving 1 kilometer to the east of the monastery is the plot of land that has been earmarked as the site for the Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center.
Here it is sufficiently secluded from the noise and distractions of modern civilization, yet supplied with electricity and clean water. Seen from the higher plains, the future Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center really isn't that far away.
In reality, a flight from Malaysia to Perth takes only about 5 hours. The land for this site has already been donated, and a contractor has been chosen. The cost price of this project is $3 million.
As of November 2006, $2 million has been collected.
The construction is scheduled to start March this year, and is targeted to complete no later than the end of the year.
By providing support, you will give opportunity for all to learn meditation from Ajahn Brahmavamsa.
By providing support, you provide facilities that are especially catered to the old and infirm to practice meditation.
You also give yourself an opportunity to contribute something meaningful to the current and future generations. Your contributions may be directed to Buddhist Society of Western Australia or the Buddhist Gem Fellowship here in Petaling Jaya.
When the Jhana Grove Meditation Retreat Center becomes a reality, may you also have the opportunity to visit and practice meditation there. Thank you.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your kind attention. As you know, development plans are in place and the construction is scheduled to start in March 2007, that is this year, targeting to complete by November 2007. The total anticipated cost for the building project is approximately $3 million. As of November 2006, $2 million have been raised and they are now working hard to raise the remainder. The proposed meditation retreat center will provide year-round meditation retreats for dedicated followers of Buddhism from all traditions. One day, may you and your family members have the opportunity to practice meditation there too. Uncles, aunties, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, this is a great opportunity for us to practice dana, giving and sharing for the cause of the Buddha Sasana. I'm sure many people have benefited from the work of Venerable Ajahn Brahm, who has compassionately and tirelessly conducting Dhamma talks and meditation retreats in Malaysia. Indeed, his knowledge and wisdom have renewed our faith in ourselves and the Buddha Dhamma. His insight has enriched our own spiritual journey, guiding us along the Buddha's path of liberation. If you feel you have benefited from him, this is the opportunity to cultivate right giving. Please open your hearts and give him the means to help more people realize the Dhamma. Sadhu. Before we start the Dhamma talk, we will sit for a while to relax ourselves and quiet our minds before the talk, okay? So just So we shall have a few moments of quiet time before the talk starts. Please sit quietly and relax your whole body and mind. Adjust your body to an upright and relaxed position. Keep your head upright and just tuck in the chin a little. Feel your shoulder and shoulder joints relax. You may choose to close or half close your eyes. Just bring your attention within. As you bring your attention within, you will free your mind from whatever events that have taken place during the day or in the past, or whatever plans that you have for the rest of the day or the future. Just let go of them and dwell in the here and now. You will observe a sense of calmness and quietness within. Just spend a few moments to experience this calm and quietness within. Just tell yourself to be well, to be happy, and keep a smile in your heart. May I respectfully invite Venerable Achan Brahmavamso to the stage. Uncles, aunties, brothers and sisters, ladies and gentlemen, please rise and put your arms together in Anjali to welcome Venerable Achan Brahm. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Please be seated. Just an announcement. For the car owner, ACR 4365, please switch off your lights. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Okasa vandami bante. My respectful salutation to Venerable Sir. Be loving, be kind, and follow the ways of goodness. Committed and longing for the goal, always keep going with courage. To dally and delay will not help you, but to be ardent is sure and safe. When you see it, cultivate the path, so you will touch and make your own the deathless way. Psalm of the early Buddhists. Venerable Sir, uncles, aunties, brothers and sisters in the Dhamma, Sukhi Hotu, may you be well. On behalf of the organizing committee, I bid you a warm welcome. I would also like to specially mention a warm welcome to our Buddhist friends from Teluk Intan. They came actually, Venerable, in one busload and a few cars. That's about 2 hours drive from Ipoh. The distinguished speaker for this evening talk is none other than Venerable Achan Brahmavamso. He is also affectionately known as Achan Brahm by many of us. Venerable was born in London in 1951. He regarded himself a Buddhist at the age of 17, but his interest in Buddhism and meditation flourished while studying theoretical physics at Cambridge University, UK. After completing his degree and teaching for a year, he travelled to Thailand to become a monk. He was ordained in Bangkok at the age of 23 by the abbot of Wat Sakut. He subsequently spent 9 years studying and training in the forest tradition of the late Pra Achan Cha. In 1993, he was asked to assist in the establishment of a forest monastery near Perth, Western Australia. Venerable is currently the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery in Serpentine and the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, teaching and training monks, anagarikas, and the lay people. Venerable is an outstanding monk, teacher, and public speaker. He is able to make the Buddhist teaching easy to understand, inspiring, and even entertaining. The topic for this evening talk is skillful living, skillful practices. May I respectfully invite Venerable Sir to share and guide with us the Buddha's teaching. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Hello. Oops. First of all, Judy and Cynthia, can you hear me well at the back? Very good. If for some reason you can't hear me at the back, please make some signs so that I can know. We have to make sure, out of care and compassion for everybody, that you can hear what's being said here tonight. But also, the title of the talk this evening, Skillful Living, as a monk who travels around the world, that it's wonderful to see the effect of Buddhism in practice. About 13 months ago, when I was staying in Bangkok for a conference, I had some very interesting anecdotes to tell you about the state of Buddhism in the world. Now, the first anecdote came from a Swedish representative who told me, this was 13 months ago in December 2005, that the Swedish government had done a survey in every high school in Sweden. They asked the school children of all ages in high school a series of questions, and one of those questions was, if you had to choose a religion, what religion would you choose? 60% wrote down Buddhism. This was in a Western European country. 60% said if they had to choose a religion, they would choose Buddhism. Why do you think that is? Why do you think it is that the other anecdote was that what some of the Thai monks were telling me, that a few months previously, the CEO of Ford Motor Corporation, a great-grandson of the founder, Henry Ford, called Bill Ford, he's the CEO, was visiting Thailand to negotiate the opening of a factory to produce Ford cars in that land. So he had a meeting with the former Prime Minister, Mr. Thaksin, and when they met together, Bill Ford's first comment was to ask Mr. Thaksin whether he knew a monk called Ajahn Chah, my teacher, because Bill Ford is a Buddhist. There are many, many people in the Western world who are taking on Buddhism simply because it has a skillful practice which actually helps and makes people better, more successful in whatever they do. And the third anecdote, or third story, is something personal. Because in April, I'll be fortunate enough to go and visit my family in London, all expenses paid. And the reason is that I'm giving a masterclass at a conference, and this is how it started. With some of my disciples in Singapore, realized that some of the things which I say are much more relevant. It's more relevant than just to Buddhists. And so they suggested that I give a session at a human resources conference. Human resources are what big corporations like to study and understand because it enhances their workforce, it makes their profits go up, and it gives more harmony and more prosperity to everybody in the company. So I went to give a small class in Singapore. But because it was an international conference, there were some people from even bigger organizations. And about 1 month later, I got an invitation to give a master class, which is a much more prominent class, at the 2007 International Human Resources and Development Conference in London. And recently I got the brochure for this conference. I'm the only religious figure there, the only Buddhist monk, and alongside of me is some very, very famous people who are actually teaching CEOs and vice presidents, MDs, how to run their company. And most of you who know me, because I'm a forest monk, I don't have any personal money at all, I am going to be the poorest person amongst all these very, very wealthy CEOs and vice presidents and MDs. And I'm going to be teaching the business people how to make more money. Alongside of me will be people like Bill Bryson. There's about 11 of us teaching there. Bill Bryson is the author of one of the bestsellers, A Short History of Everything. There's also Greg Dyke. If you remember your news, he was the head of the BBC, who was forced to resign on the political issue of exposing Tony Blair's weapons of mass destruction fiasco. And so he had to resign. These are other people who are... There's also this a very interesting lady. She is the chairman of Millwall Football Club. She's also a director of the Bank of England as well. So, and as well as the director of the Bank of England, the ex-head of the BBC, very famous authors, they also have Ajahn Brahm as well. Now, why is it that I'm invited to teach business people how to be more successful? Because some of the things which you hear here today, skillful living, is not just what you do in the temple. And Buddhism never was just about what you do in the temple. It was all about what you do in life. About how to be more peaceful, more successful in whatever you do. And for example, a couple of weeks ago I was in Penang, just before the New Year. And one of the disciples there came to thank me because she had got a very important promotion. And the reason she got the promotion, she was in IT, in customer service, was something which I told her the time before, which is actually in my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, which that's actually been now translated into 9 languages. Been translated into Russian, into Portuguese, into Danish, into German, it's in Indonesian, in Chinese, in Thai, Sinhalese, and what else? Something else. But one of the stories in that book which caused her to have a promotion was this following story, which is a great story about how to have skillful living. This particular story, actually, you won't find in a Buddhist text because this was written sometime later by a very famous Russian author called Leo Tolstoy. And this was the story of the Emperor's 3 questions. And I'll say something else about that story afterwards, but the story was this. There was an emperor who was a free thinker, who was not all that impressed with the religions at that time. They seemed to be always arguing with each other. So he wanted to find out a religion which could satisfy his philosophy, but also be practical enough to help him with his job of ruling a kingdom. And after much consideration and much discussion with other wise people, he decided if he could only have the answers to three questions, he would have all the religion and philosophy he ever needed. And the story which he wrote is how he found the answers to those emperor's three questions. He eventually found it just in the experiences of life with a small boy. But first of all, what were those three questions? Question number one was, when? When is the most important time? Question number two, who is the most important person? And question number three, what is the most important thing to do? I'll repeat that. When is the most important time? Who is the most important person? What is the most important thing to do? So now I'm going to ask you, when is the most important time? Correct? Do you always remember that? When is the most important time to say sorry to your partner? Now, so if they're sitting next to you, turn around to them and say sorry. When is the most important time to say how much you respect your parents? Now, because sometimes if they're sitting next to you, you know, a couple of kids, you can say, Mum, I really love you very much. Daddy, thank you so much. If you do that, you'll get more pocket money next week. It's skillful practice, even for kids. So now is the most important time. Now the answer to the next question, the second question, is the central question of the emperor's three questions. It's the most important. And it's not an answer you'd probably find by yourself. Who is the most important person? I thought when I first was asked that, I thought it was oneself. And that's wrong. The most important person is the one you're with. Whoever that happens to be. Unfortunately, sometimes when you go and speak with somebody, have you ever felt they're trying to get rid of you? That then you're not really important to them? They're saying, come on, get out of the way, I want to do something else. Unfortunately, that person in front of you is sometimes your husband. Or sometimes your wife as well. What does it feel like when you're trying to say something to your partner and you don't feel important? When they are not listening, they're trying to get rid of you and go do something else. If that happens too often, your marriage is not much of a marriage anymore. And in countries where you can get divorced, that's what happens. This is where the relationship breaks down. But if you imagine that the person in front of you, if that's your partner in front of you, your husband, your wife, and every time they were in front of you, you said, you're the one in front of me, you're the most important person in the world right now. Imagine what it would feel like. Because you're giving importance to them, and they feel that importance, they feel that you're respecting them. You're listening. It doesn't matter whether you agree or not, but the very fact you're listening is enough to keep that love, that relationship going strong. But at work, if you practice the person in front of you is the most important person, and that's what this young girl in Penang was telling me she was doing throughout the whole year in customer service. Even though she was very, very busy and many people were asking her questions, it was the one in front of her now was the most important person. And they felt that. which meant that she was the most popular customer service person they've ever had. She listened, the customers knew she was listening, and they came back again, they praised her, she got commendations, so she got the promotion. In business, you have to listen to your customers. Otherwise, your customers will go to another shop. You have to listen to find out your customers' needs so you can adapt to your market. Which is why when I'm talking, you know, I'm always looking around because I have to also adapt to my customers, which are you. Otherwise, I'm never going to get anywhere in my job. So customer service is making people feel important. And that's also with your employees or your employers, your bosses. If you, the person in front of you is the most important person in the world, it's incredible how successful you can be. And whatever project you are undertaking, how successful that can be as well. And the most important thing to do is to care. To care is halfway between being careful and being caring. Being careful is what we call in Buddhism mindfulness. Being caring is compassion. Being mindful and being compassionate is what we mean by saying to care. So those were the answers to the Emperor's three questions. Many years ago, I got an invitation to another seminar, but this was in Perth, to give a keynote speech at an education seminar. I didn't know why I was supposed to go, but the invitation carried a free breakfast. So I thought, as a mic, that's a good reason for going. So I went there for a nice breakfast, but when I went into the hall, a big hall like this, a lady came up to me and she had a badge on her saying that she was the organizer, the head person. She came straight up to me and said, "Do you remember me?" That's a terrible question to ask anybody. Especially a monk. Because we're honest and we're likely to say, "No, I don't remember you." Which is embarrassing. So being honest, I said, "I don't know who you are." Fortunately, she laughed. And then she told me who she was. And then I understood why I was invited to this big seminar with all of these important people from the education department, ministers, you know, the CEOs of the education department. This was a big meeting. And the reason why it was arranged was this. She reminded me that 7 years previously, I'd given a talk at the school where she was the principal, the headmistress. After hearing my talk, she sent in her resignation the next morning. Now is the most important time. Because she heard my talk, and those Emperor's three questions hit her deep inside. Because she'd always wanted to do something, not just for the children who were being educated in the schools, but she wanted to help people who weren't in the education system. If you had seen movies, documentaries about Western countries, sometimes there are what we call street kids. Children who've run away from home, who live in petty crime, who take drugs, not just boys, but girls as well, who sell their bodies for sex, and they're only 14 or 15 years of age. People who even the police cannot catch. People who aren't in the system anymore.
people who are doing petty crimes like burglary, these are the people who the system hasn't managed to help. And so she said, I want to help these people. And the emperor's three questions, or rather their answers, was the underlying philosophy for her program. She went out under the bridges into the parks, the places where these street children lived during the day. When she met them, she made sure that they felt that they were important. In front of her, they were the most important people in the world. And she said an amazing thing happened. That for many of those kids who had very poor upbringings, it was one of the first times that anyone, any adult, had given them respect. Of course, you'd think they're not deserving of respect, but if they're in front of you, it doesn't matter who they are the most important people in the world. So they began to tell their stories, so she could understand where they were coming from and why they could not go to school. And she also understood what was happening inside of them. So she went back home and made out a program, an education program, to try and get these kids not back into a normal school, but to adapt some sort of classes especially suited for these kids. She sold it to the education department. A program was started, funded by the West Australian government. And this seminar was to celebrate its success. In the end, I never gave the keynote address. I gave a couple of stories. But the keynote address was two of these kids who came up on stage and told a story of their lives. How maybe their mother was a prostitute, their father was a drug, they'd run away from home because they weren't being fed or they were being beaten savagely. They had no place to go, so they lived on the streets. And one of these kids was telling his story about when he met this girl under the bridge. And how she cared. And she listened. And he had a program where he could go at his own time, at his own pace. And then he's in front of everybody. He almost made me cry when he said, now I'm going to university. He passed his university entrance. He was soon to go to a university. Another girl came up. She was a prostitute, about 14. She too said one day she's going to get there. Lives had been turned around. Kids had been saved. And it wasn't some big religious crusade. All it was the common sense, the deep spiritual answers of the emperor's three questions. Now the most important time. The most important person is the one you're with. And the most important thing to do is to care. And that has been saving many, many, many people's lives. And that's what we mean, skillful practice. So for those of you who may have trouble with your kids, they're obviously not as bad as those extreme cases which I've been talking about. But sometimes your children may be in a bit of difficulty in their life. Or there may be some troubles with them because they're depressed or they're anxious or they're not doing so well at school. Look, most of you are Buddhists here. If your child comes in the top 5% at school or the bottom 5%, they're not good Buddhists. Good Buddhists should never come at the top or the bottom. Haven't you heard about the middle way? They should be in the middle somewhere. That's good Buddhists. No extremes. So, that's only a joke. Whatever your kid can do, you try and encourage them. But, Don't force them too much. If you want your child to be successful, what's the most important thing for success? It's not passing exams. It's not being clever and going to university. Research which was published last year is a very great research, and this also goes for your companies and business, for your life in general, for your health even. The research which was shown was answering the question, are happy people successful, or are successful people happy? Which comes first in life? Success or happiness? But why is it you say, okay child, you get your A levels first, you get your degree first, and then you can be happy? Or why is it you think, I'm going to work really, really hard, never see my family, because I'm saving up to make sure they've got a good education, a nice house, and then we'll be happy? You all know that the answer is happiness comes first, and happy people are successful. But we forget that. You know, you may know, those of you who have seen me before, you've heard me say that in Australia, in many Western countries, Buddhism is expanding. And if you see me, I'm expanding too. It's not my fault, because all you generous dana givers, you give me too much to eat every day. But, have you ever noticed that fat people are always happy? Have you ever seen fat people who are miserable? They don't exist, and I found out the reason why. This is science. Again, last year, I was a scientist before, theoretical physics at Cambridge in England. And I always keep in touch with modern science. And one of the things which I found only about 2 or 3 months ago, a doctor sent me the article. They just found in the UK that when you laugh, the arteries in your body expand. If you're miserable, they contract. So if you've got a bit too much cholesterol, you better laugh quickly to give it space to pass through. So you've already lessened your tendency to a heart attack by, I don't know, 100% by laughing at that. So what actually happens, if you're fat and miserable, then sure, the cholesterol gets stuck somewhere and that's it. But as long as you keep laughing, you can have a bit of extra weight and it balances. So those of you who are overweight, make sure you laugh a lot. Saves your life. Which means the only fat people left, all the fat miserable ones have already died. The only ones left are the fat ones who are happy. Which is why we always associate fat people with happy people. So, happiness comes first. And success and even long life come afterwards. So the best thing you can encourage your children, if you really care about them, encourage them to be happy before being successful. If you give them happiness first, the success will follow afterwards. But keep your priorities right. Happiness is more important. Some years ago, and actually not quite recently, a man came home from work. His 6-year-old boy was waiting for him. His 6-year-old said, Daddy, how much do you earn at work? And Daddy said, look, be quiet, son, I'm tired. You know what it's like when you've been working all day? But son said, Daddy, please, how much do you earn every hour at your job? Look, I've told you, be quiet. What does a 6-year-old want to know about that for? But Daddy, how many dollars do you earn every hour? That's enough! I gave you 3 warnings, go to your room. He was angry at his 6-year-old. So the little boy hung his head. He was almost crying as he had to go into his room as a punishment for upsetting his father. When his father had relaxed, he started feeling very guilty. His son had only asked a small question, but the father had got angry at him and scolded him, mostly because his father was tired after a busy day at the office. So feeling guilty, he went into his son's room and said, "I'm sorry, son. I was tired. I should not have shouted at you. But I don't know why you want to know this, but actually I earn $20 an hour at my job." And the son said, "Thank you, father. Now, can I borrow $10, please?" And the father was about to say, "What? You can't..." But he'd already gotten angry once today. And he decided, "I'm not going to get angry again." And he got out his wallet. "I don't know why my six-year-old wants $10, but here you are, take it." And his little six-year-old smiled and took the $10. Then he reached under his pillow and took out another $10 in coins and small notes. He counted out $20 in front of his father and said, "Here you are, father. Here's $20. Now can I have 1 hour of your time, please?" You understand that story? Why is it that we're so busy we can't spend time with our kids? That's all they ever want. If you can spend time with your family, especially with your children, you are going to make them very successful in life. It's time which they want, because happiness and then success happens afterwards. I mentioned earlier that those Emperor's Three Questions, they are very, very powerful in life. And those, I think some of you, went to my hometown of Perth in Western Australia last year, because in June I held the fourth global conference on Buddhism. The fifth global conference is going to be held in Kuala Lumpur in Malaysia in November this year. So please go, they're great conferences. But at the fourth conference, I invited to open the conference and also to give a keynote speech the then head of the West Australian government, the Premier. In Australia, it is like a federal system like the United States. And every state doesn't have a governor like in the United States, but has a Premier. They do the same job. And the Premier was a man called Dr. Jeff Gallop. He was Premier at the time, and he is, I would say now, a Buddhist. Some of the other cabinet members told me, whenever there was an argument in the cabinet, in the government, it was Jeff Gallop would thump the table and said, "Be quiet, we should be more Buddhist about this." In other words, more cool, more peaceful, more together. So I've known him for many years, we invited him, but unfortunately, about 12 months ago, almost 12 months to the day, when he came back from his holidays, he held a press conference to announce his resignation. He resigned because he was suffering from depression, serious clinical depression. But he still came to my conference. He still gave the speech. He still remains a close friend. I got a letter from him about 2 or 3 days before I came here. And some of my disciples in Sydney, where he's moved to, sent me a couple of speeches he'd given about depression. This is a very prominent man in Australia. An ex-premier, he's now writing a weekly column for the Australian newspaper, the main international newspaper. He's a professor of politics at the University of Sydney. And they sent me a draft, or not a draft, a copy of his speech on depression, because it started off by saying, first let me quote my good friend Ajahn Brahm. And then he started quoting story after story from my book, Opening the Door of Your Heart, and how Eastern philosophy, and especially meditation, was helping him with his depression. And that was sort of publicity for what I'm teaching here, skillful living, of how to deal with something like depression, which was working. Now, it's very important to get such people as meditators. He is now the patron of the Meditation Retreat Center project. Not Jhana Grove. Somebody made a typographical error and they put two O's in there. Jhana Groove project. So it's groovy to meditate at Jhana Grove Retreat Center. But he considered his resignation because of depression when he was on vacation 12 months ago at Chequers in England at the country residence of Tony Blair, the Prime Minister. And the reason is because he's one of Tony Blair's closest friends. They were at Oxford together, and this Dr. Jeff Gallup was the best man at Tony and Cherry's wedding. So now we have Jeff Gallup as a disciple of Ajahn Brahm. It's only a short step before we get Tony Blair coming to the Jhana Grove Retreat Center, and then with him he might invite his best friend, George W. Bush. And then we have changed the world! Who knows? You know, just one or two steps away. So those of you who support the Jhana Grove Monastery, you may be changing the course of history. But more than that, it's the kindness. And the kindness, one of the other stories in that book, which actually does change things for skillful living. We all talk about compassion and kindness. Especially in Buddhism, we make a huge thing about that. But sometimes we don't know what compassion and kindness is. One of the most powerful stories I have in my book, again a personal anecdote, when I was about 12 or 13, my father took me aside to give me some advice which I was to remember for the rest of my life. He was a poor man, because he was always very sick. He told me, he said, "Son, wherever you go and whatever you do, however you turn out in life, always remember the door of my house will always be open to you. Please remember, whatever you do, however you turn out, wherever you go, the door of my house will always be open to you." His house was a small, what they called in London, council flat. An apartment which was owned by the government and subsidized, so it was a very, very small rent. Because he was poor. In fact, he was so poor, we were never afraid of burglars. In fact, we used to leave the door open, hoping burglars would come in, take pity on us and leave us something. But I realized later on, that's not what he meant, the door of his house. He meant something more. When I became a monk and remembered that occasion when my father said the door of his house was always open, I realized what he meant was to say, "Son, wherever you go, whatever you do, always remember the door of my heart will always be open to you. You're my son, I love you, that's enough. Whatever you do, the door of my heart will always be open to you. To me, even now, that's the most clear and meaningful description of compassion that I've ever had. What it means is turning to your children and telling them the same. Son, daughter, I might disapprove of what you do sometimes, but please understand this. Wherever you go, whatever you do, whatever happens, you're my child. The door of my heart will always be open to you. And maybe once you've done that to your children, see if you can turn around and say that to your husband. To your wife. Why not? Isn't that what unconditional love is? Say, darling, you're the one I've chosen. Wherever you go, whatever happens, please know the door of my heart is open to you. I now say that to you, as a monk. It don't matter what you do, where you go, what happens, the door of my heart will always be open to you. And I will never get angry at you. For those of you who have known me for a long time, have you ever seen me get angry at you? Why? Because the door of my heart will never close. It's wide open. This is what we mean by compassion and kindness. But it has to go even further than that if you want to overcome depression, pain, disappointment in life. If you want to understand what enlightenment is, the goal of Buddhism, then one day sit down alone and say that to yourself. Me, the one I've known more than anybody else, yourself, whatever I've done, the door of my heart is open to me. To open the door of your heart to yourself. No matter what you've ever done, no matter who you are, no matter if you've achieved a lot or a little, to be at peace with yourself. To open the door of your heart. If you could do that, all your problems in life will just vanish. You'll be at ease and at peace with yourself. There's no more ill will or hatred or negativity to your past, to your present, or even your future. Do you understand what I mean there? It's embracing, accepting, letting go with kindness. It's the Buddha speaking. The door of my heart is open to yourself. Because too often people get depressed and angry because they dwell on all the things which have gone wrong in the past. Why do you keep thinking of all the things which went wrong in the past? Once there were two chicken farmers. The first chicken farmer was not very clever. In the morning he went to the chicken shed with the basket. He collected all the chicken poo, the dung. And he put that in the basket and he left all the eggs to rot. That was a very dumb chicken farmer. Chicken farmer number two, he left all the dung, all the excrement to rot. And he collected the eggs so he could make an omelette for his family and sell the rest of the eggs in the market for cash. That's a very clever chicken farmer. Now the meaning of the story is this. When you go and collect the produce of your past, when you think of what you've done today, yesterday, last week, the whole year, your whole life, what do you collect? The eggs or the smelly dung? What type of chicken farmer are you? Why is it we always collect the bad stuff? When you think what you've done today, what happened? Do you just remember the mistakes, the pain, the argument? In your life with your partner, what do you remember? When I was in KL a few years ago, I gave a talk at one of the universities. After the talk, at question time, someone put their hand up and said, "I want to ask this question. My husband has just lied to me. Should I get divorced? I can't trust him anymore." It's a fair question. If you've been in a partnership and your husband has lied to you, clearly lied, she said, "I can't trust him any longer. Should I get divorced?" So before I gave an answer, I decided to find out some more information. "Are you a student here or are you on the faculty?" She said, "I'm a professor here of mathematics." "How long have you been married?" She said, "3 years." Now, I used to do math, science, it's the same, it's all sums. So I said, "Let's do some statistics. You must know statistics. Yeah, I teach statistics. So let's do some statistics. You've been married for 3 years. Let's say that's about... Let's assume that every day, averaged out over 3 years, your husband has said, say, 20 things to you which could have been right or which could have been wrong. So he said 20,000 things to you since you've been married, and now he's lied for the first time. According to probability theory, it means the next time he opens his mouth, there's a 20,000 to 1 chance he's telling the truth. What do you mean you can't trust him? That's pretty trustworthy to me, 20,000 to 1. When I said it like that, she laughed and she saw the meaning. Why is it that one lie is all we see and we forget the 20,000 truthful statements? Why do we do that? The reason is because we're stupid. Because we look at the wrong things. The reason is because when you were small, you were taught to learn from your mistakes. You know, you don't learn much from your mistakes, except you learn to get depressed, negative, and angry. Why instead don't we learn from our successes? This is why I teach at these big human resources conferences. I tell CEOs, stop looking for what went wrong. Look at what went right. Why you made a profit last year? Why? Look at the reasons for success and learn from those. And you repeat those successes and you'll become even more successful. If you've had a good day today, why? Learn from those successes. If your wife has been really nice to you today, why? What did you do? Do it again. If your husband has been really nice and soft and gentle, you know, just a really nice husband for a change, then why? See if you can repeat what causes successes. Learn from successes. And it's far better to learn from successes than to learn from mistakes. For example, sometimes as a wife, you know, in Malaysia, the husband, Chinese culture, the husband's the boss. It seems that way, but you can be clever. This is how to get your own way without your husband knowing. Or, this is skillful living. Or how to influence your boss at work. You know that sometimes you have these great ideas and the boss doesn't listen? This is Buddhist psychology. Don't just use force, psychology, for goodness sake. Buddhism, because it's a religion based on meditation, understanding the nature of the mind, it's amazing just how clever you can be. You know, in the West is a whole new area of Buddhist psychology taught in universities, simply because it knows that the meditating tradition has understood the mind so well. We've got great ideas. 2,500 years ago, the Buddha understood the mind better than anybody today. And that works because people are reintroducing these old techniques. And one of these techniques I learned when I was number 2 monk at my monastery in Perth. I had a boss as well. And sometimes the boss I had, who was senior to me as a monk, he was just so hard to give advice to. He was just so arrogant and bossy. So one day when we were building up our monastery, I was like a builder in the first years as a monk. And so I remember telling him once, you know, we need to build another hut for the monks. Because we were expanding, getting more monks. We needed a monk's hut. We call them kuti. Kuti is the word for a monk's dwelling. So I said, we need another kuti. Why don't we build that kuti, the monk's hut, on the hill? He said, on that hill? That's a stupid idea. Don't be ridiculous. Now, I was smart. I knew psychology. I said, okay, yeah, oh, fair enough. And I dropped it. I never mentioned it for about 2 weeks. This is all planned. I knew how it works. 2 weeks later, when I thought he'd forgotten it, I mentioned it again. Now, why don't we build a hut on the hill over there? Again, he said, that's a stupid idea. That's ridiculous. It's the worst place for a hut. Oh, okay, never mind. The important thing is, don't keep pushing. Otherwise, it doesn't work. You've got to go into the subconscious. You've got to be sneaky. And it always worked. Maybe repeat it another time at most. 2 times or 3 times, it all what was needed. And then what would happen? I'd be walking with another senior monk, and then out of nowhere he would say, you know, that's a nice place for the hut over there on that hill. And I'd always say, wow, what a great idea of yours. Now, how that works with a boss is you put the idea in. And when you mention something, it goes in the subconscious. If you push too much, they know what you're up to. So you just make a little suggestion. And don't push, let it go. You reinforce it, usually about 2 weeks later is the best time. When they've completely forgotten, they don't know what you're up to. Reinforce it. They'll say the same, a stupid idea. Forget it. Because it's working around the subconscious. If it really is a good idea, they see it themselves. It's like hypnosis. It's like advertising. And you repeat the message on the TV 3 or 4 times. If it really is a good message, it becomes your idea. And think, yeah, let's build a hut on the hill over there. But the thing is, with a boss, you always have to say, what a great idea of yours, boss. If you want to get on in the world, that's what you have to say. But you've got your way. So are your wives. If you want a new dress, say, look, I really need a new dress. Ah, you've got too many dresses already. Oh, yeah, that's true. Shh. 2 weeks later, you know this, I really need a new dress. Ah, stupid idea. And you'll find, 2 weeks after that, your husband say, you know, I think you need a new dress. Oh, you're so kind, husband. But you did it all the time. That's a psychology. So don't learn from your mistakes. Learn from your successes. Then you don't have depression. You don't have negativity. You don't get angry. And you learn what works and you become more successful in your life. It's kindness, loving kindness. It's wisdom. And it works so well. And it's because of that that, you know, these things like Buddhism is really spreading in this world. It's a gentle, very kind, beautiful message. And it's not violent, and it's also good fun as well. For example, it was a couple of years ago, you know, people asking me, what's the, you know, the Buddhist answer to terrorism? Because at that time, there was, in all the newspapers throughout the world, there was the accusations against the US Marines in Guantanamo Bay. They said had actually taken a copy of the Holy Quran, put it in the toilet and flushed it down the toilet. Do you remember that? So a couple of days later, in Perth, they asked me, Ajahn Brahm, you're a Buddhist. What would you do as a Buddhist if they took a Buddhist holy book and flushed that down the toilet? So straight away, if they took a Buddhist holy book and flushed it down the toilet, the first thing I'd do is call a plumber. We are very practical. You've got to use that toilet later. So you've got to make sure. But then I said, I've made them laugh. I said, look, the last thing I'm going to do is to get angry and upset. Because you can flush a Buddhist holy book down the toilet, but I'm not going to allow you to flush Buddhism down the toilet. I'm not going to allow you to flush peace, compassion, forgiveness, love, virtue down the toilet. And I made the distinction between what I call the container and the contents. The books are containers. Even the statues, they're containers. Even the temples, they're containers. It's the contents is what's most important. What's actually inside those books? What does the Buddha symbolize? Why have you got a temple here? And the reason is because this is supposed to be encouraging virtue, peace, truth, kindness, compassion. I said, that's what you can never destroy. So you can even kill me, but please don't allow peace, virtue, forgiveness to be killed. When you understand the difference between the container and the contents, it makes it much easier to understand what religion truly is. We do have many different containers. If you go deep inside, you find very similar contents. So virtue, peace, compassion, love, harmony, working together. Because only when we work together can we solve the problems of this world. We can never solve them alone, especially when we're arguing. So when we can learn how to work together, it's amazing what we can achieve. And I'll finish off with this beautiful symbol of religious harmony. This is actually in my book. It's called The Simile of the Old Man and the Violin. It's one of my favorite stories in that book. Many years ago, there was an old man who lived high in the mountains in a very poor village. And like many parents, he worked so hard for his children's education. He managed to save enough to send his children to good schools, even though he was a poor man just, you know, working up in the mountains. And eventually he managed even to send his children, because they did well at school, to universities. He sacrificed everything for his children's education. You can understand why, because you sometimes do the same, or maybe your parents sacrificed for you, so you could be where you are now. And once his children had passed their university and established themselves as lawyers or doctors or business people in the city, one day they met together and said, our father has helped us so much. Why don't we invite him into the city and really look after him? Because he's never been here before. He spent all his life up in the mountains. So they decided to invite their father for the first time to see a modern city. And of course, if you've lived all of your time, all of your life up in the mountains, the cities are very strange and wonderful places. He saw things you never see. in the mountains. And one day he was walking through a part of the city when he heard a terrible, terrible sound. It was the worst noise he'd ever heard in his whole life. No worse than the crow, ga, ga, ga. You know where crows come from? They're men, the wives and husbands who talk badly to each other, who nag too much. In your next life you get reborn as crow. Ga, 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 ga. But this was worse than that. But nevertheless, he wanted to find out what caused this awful sound. So he followed it to its source, and in a small room at the back of a house, he saw a young boy playing a musical instrument. What's that musical instrument? It's a violin, he was told. What a terrible thing this violin is. I never want to hear a violin ever again. He was a simple man. He had no education. He thought it was the violin's fault. And the next day, different part of town, he heard this most beautiful sound. He followed that to its source. It was a violin again, but this time being played by a maestro, by an old woman who had been practicing the violin all her life. And then he realized his mistake. It wasn't the violin's fault. Because that little boy had yet to learn how to play his instrument well. At the same time he thought, yeah, that's the same with religions in this world. We can very easily criticize the religion, but really it's because we've never seen anyone playing it well yet. And if you see someone who's a maestro of their faith, what a beautiful sound they make. But that's not the end of the story, because the next day the old man heard a sound which surpassed in its beauty, far surpassed the beauty of the old woman, the maestro, playing a violin. It was the most beautiful sound he'd ever heard. It was more enchanting than the sound of the mountain stream after heavy rainfall. More beautiful and thrilling than the sound of the birds in the early morning, or even of the wind rustling the trees up in the high mountain forests. It was the most beautiful sound in the world. You know what that sound was? It was an orchestra. It was the most beautiful sound for two reasons. The first reason was everyone in that orchestra was a maestro of their own instrument. First, they learned to play their own individual instrument, whether it was a tuba, a clarinet, or a violin, so well. Number one, they were maestros of their own instrument. And number two, they learned to play together in harmony. And he thought what a wonderful thing it would be if people of all religions learned their religion so well they were maestros, and then learned to play together in harmony and peace. What a beautiful sound that would be. Skillful living, skillful practice, peaceful world. Thank you. Now we have the time for Q&A, questions. And the reason we have question time now, I think you can either come to the microphone, or if there's pieces of paper you can actually write your questions down on and pass them to the front, is because in one old teaching of the Buddha, this is in the sutras, the Buddha started talking about the idea in Buddhism about karma and reincarnation. Because somebody, one person asked him, why is it that some people are born into wealthy families? And sometimes whatever they do, they tend to make lots of money, while other people are born so poor. What did they do in their last life to be poor? Why did they? The Buddha started talking about the karmic causes for the differences of people in this world. Now why is it? What do you have to do in this life to be reborn in a rich family in the next life? And why are some people born poor? He started talking about the karmic causes. He also started to talk about what you have to do to be reborn beautiful and why some people are reborn ugly. And when I say ugly, I decide I will never look at anybody. Because once when I said ugly, I was looking at one particular woman and she complained, "Ajahn Brahm, why were you looking at me when you said ugly?" I thought, I always look at the floor when I tell this story now. But in particular, the Buddha said, what's the karmic cause for intelligence? And why are some people born stupid, dumb? They go to school, they just can't pass the exams. What did they do in the last life to lack intelligence in this one? And the Buddha said, the karmic cause for lack of intelligence in your next life is because you didn't ask questions in this life. Any questions?
Bhante, we have some questions from the floor.
Great, some people are going to be intelligent in Ipoh and Teluk Intan in your future life.
Bhante, okay. There are questions. Bhante,
the
young are generally not interested in the Dhamma. What are the skillful ways to get them interested?
Okay, just before I went up to, where was it, to KL, I gave a retreat in Chimpaka Buddhist Lodge just in mid-December. Before I went up there, the night before, I was teaching in a youth camp for the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore. So there they had a group of kids from 16 to 25, doing something together to learn Buddhism. And they wanted me to give them a talk. So I looked upon them and looked, what are 16 to 25 year olds interested in? Are they really interested in Four Noble Truths and Eightfold Path? No. What the boys are interested in is girls. What the girls are interested in is boys. So I decided to teach them Dhamma which would interest them, which would also be helpful for their lives. So the first thing I did, I looked at the girls and I said, what really impresses you in a boy? What type of boy do you like? Is it a boy who takes drugs or gets drunk and does stupid things? I said, no. Is it a boy who spends his money wearing designer clothes? Or, puts studs in his nose or whatever? No. What are you looking for in a boy? They said, someone who is kind and trustworthy and good fun. And it was very important that the boys were listening. Because of course they want to attract the girls. They just didn't know how or what they're supposed to do. And then I turned to the boys. What attracts you to a girl? Does she have to wear expensive clothes and expensive perfumes? They said, no, that's not what we want. It's amazing because they said that they wanted girls who were also, trustworthy, kind and good fun. They wanted the same thing. But the trouble is, you didn't know that. So some girls have to spend a fortune on makeup and clothes. You don't need to do that. You spend a fortune learning how to be happy, learning how to be virtuous, learning how to be kind. That's what attracts people. So this is actually putting Dhamma into kids. If you want to have a nice girlfriend, then be a good person. Be a good person. Be kind, be trustworthy, and be light-hearted, have some fun. That's more attractive than some boys trying to show off by driving fast motorbikes and killing themselves. People think that's what they need. Or going into fights, look how tough and strong I am. That doesn't impress. So that's actually how I taught Dhamma to kids. And they were paying full attention when I was speaking. Because they want to find out what we need to do to get a nice girlfriend or boyfriend. See, this is actually how you teach Dhamma to that age group. You find out what they're interested in, and you can teach that. So that's how we do it. Okay, next question.
Next question.
If one's child or children are born either physically or mentally challenged, is it because of karma? How does one overcome the pain, the disappointment, and the many emotional and financial difficulties that lies ahead?
Okay, sometimes we in the past we used to call them disabled children. I've never seen a disabled child. All I've seen is a child with a disability. I've never seen a sick person. I've seen a person with a sickness. When I went to visit prisons, I've never seen a criminal. I've always seen a person who's done a crime. You may think this language is the same, but it's not. It's very different. I remember first learning this from a psychology parable. There were two children at a supermarket with their mothers. You know, in the checkout aisles, you know, before you pay for your groceries or whatever else you're buying in these modern stores, it just happened that one of the children dropped a carton of milk and it went splat all over the floor. At the same time, the child in the next aisle dropped a jar of honey. And that broke on the floor as well. But the mother of the child who dropped the milk said, "You stupid boy." The mother of the boy who dropped the honey said, "That was a stupid thing you did." There is a world of difference between saying, "You stupid child," as if the whole child was stupid. If you do that, the child is likely to grow up stupid. Instead of focusing on that one thing they did, "That's a stupid thing you did." Fair enough. There's many people who've done crimes, done stupid things, but they're not criminals, they're not stupid people. Otherwise, if you call a person a criminal and they think they're a criminal, they become a criminal, which is why when they get released from jail, they go back again. They reoffend. That's why I've never seen a criminal. All I've seen is people who have done crimes. So if you've got a husband who's been cheating on you, he's not an adulterer. He's a man who has committed adultery. There's much more to him than that. If you just see the crime, there's no way of forgiving. If you see more than that, there is a way beyond. It's the same as if you've got cancer. Why is it that when people, they got cancer, we think that cancer is all they are? They're not a cancer patient. They got a person who has a cancer. And sometimes their cancer is only in a small part of the body. What about the rest of their body? By saying that, I'm saying that you are always bigger than your cancer. You are bigger than your mistakes. You're even bigger than your crimes. Understanding that gives a different perspective. Understanding that is how we see the bigger picture. Which means when you go and see someone in hospital, never talk to the sickness. Just talk to the person. Don't go in there and say, "How are you feeling today?" That is the stupidest question in the whole world. "Of course I'm feeling bad. I wouldn't be in hospital, would I?" So, always speak to the person. They're much bigger than that. And this is actually how you look at someone who has a disability. Don't just look at their disability. There's more to them than that. And this is actually how people deal with those problems. There's a person there. There's a huge life. There's many, many things they do, can do. And when a person doesn't focus on their disability, but focus on the other part of them, which is usually bigger, it's incredible what so-called people with disabilities can do in life. For example, look at Professor Stephen Hawking. Just one of the most famous physicists in the world, one of the famous scientists in the world, who is in a wheelchair, has to speak to a computer synthesizer. But look what he's done. There's so many other people like him who have not been held back by a disability because they see much more than that. So is it some bad karma? Is it always some bad karma? There's some good karma there as well. The rest of them, they've got a human life. So always look upon the positive side. The negative side is there as well, but don't focus on the negative. There's much more going on there. So see the big picture, and the answer to that question becomes quite clear.
May we take one question from the floor?
Yes,
just come forward to the mic.
Microphone. Well, that one will do, yeah, I think. Should do.
A very good evening to you, Venerable.
Good evening.
I have a few questions.
Okay, maybe one first of all, and then we see how it goes.
Yeah. Actually, there are three questions.
Okay, I'll carry on.
From the simple to the complex. What is suffering all about?
What is suffering all about? Suffering is asking from the world what it could never give you. Once there was a man who had a chicken. And he really, really, really wanted it to be a duck and go quack, quack. But his chicken would always go cock-a-doodle-doo, and that gave him such a headache. He was a man who had a chicken and wanted to be a duck. That's called suffering. Some people are married to a girl, and they want her to be Angelina Jolie. A chicken's a chicken, a duck's a duck. Sometimes they want their kid, you know, to get the best result in university, and to get straight A's in A-levels, and go to Oxford, Cambridge, Harvard or Princeton. Please love your child for who he is. Chickens are chickens, ducks and ducks, and they're all really valued in life. If you want something from life which it can't give you, that's called suffering. Okay, next question.
Okay, the next question is, what do you do if the suffering has no let up, yet you are feeling trapped in a vicious circle? It goes over and over again. No matter how much meditation you do, how much prayers you do or say, you are still in the same vicious circle. And it becomes a pattern that you expect the same result to be there. That you are immune to it.
Okay, what you do, you can't change the world, but you can always change your attitude. This once, one of my monks was teaching in a top security prison in Western Australia. After 3 or 4 weeks, the people in jail, they got to like this monk, so they said, can you stay afterwards? We'll give you some tea. Just have a chit-chat. So he stayed, and they were asking many questions. What they asked him, first of all, well, what's it like in a Buddhist monastery? What do you guys do? And so he told them about life in a monastery such as mine. He said, we get up at 4 o'clock in the morning. 4 o'clock, said the prisoners. Even in jail you don't have to get up that time in the morning. Then what do? You watch TV? No TVs in forest monasteries. You just have to meditate. Well, I suppose you're monks, that's what monks do. But then you have breakfast. Many monks eat one meal a day. No breakfast. If we do, it's so simple, no choice. Wow, in prison you can get much breakfast. Okay, what do you do after breakfast? You know, can you sort of go and hang out and just play sport, have a game of soccer? No, we don't have sport in a monastery. Actually, one day we thought of actually starting a Buddhist soccer team. But we remembered what would happen if we had a Buddhist soccer team. Like, compassion is so important. If the other team wanted the ball, here, you have it, go on. There you go. And if they couldn't score a goal themselves, we score it for them. letting go, compassion. We wouldn't do very well, so that's why we don't play sport. So, but then I suppose you have your lunch. Yeah, in my monastery, we eat out of a bowl. Everything goes in the same bowl in my monastery. Sometimes we get ice cream on top of the curry. Sometimes we have custard goes on top of the spaghetti. Yuck! Said the prisoners. Even in jail, they give you a metal plate that's got compartments on it. So what do you do in the afternoon? You know, can you sort of, you know, play video games or play cards? No, it's more meditation all afternoon. Oh boy. But I suppose you hang out for dinner. Dinner? Theravada monks, the last meal of the day is before lunch. Afternoon, evening, night time, there's nothing to eat at all. That's terrible! Well, what do you do in the evening? Can you get a guitar and play guitar? Or sing or something? No, we can't do any of that either. What time do you go to bed? Bed? Most of the monks, like myself, we sleep on the floor. On the floor? They don't give you even a bed to sleep on? That's terrible in your monastery. And they were so upset. I'm coming to the point in a moment. They're so upset with life in a Buddhist monastery, how tough it is. It was more austere than a prison. That one of them, the prisoners, forgot where they were and said, "That's terrible in your monastery. Why don't you come in here and stay with us instead?" That happened, true. But what is the difference between a monastery and a prison? Why is it we have a waiting list of people trying to join, but in prison there's a waiting list trying to get out? Now is the important part of this, which will answer your problem or your question. What is a prison? A prison is any place you don't want to be. Even if you're living in a 5-star hotel and you're homesick, your hotel becomes a prison for you. If you're in a job you hate, your office is your prison. If you're in a marriage which is very painful, your marriage is a prison. If you're in a body which is sick and hurting, sometimes if you don't want to be in your body becomes a prison. Any place you don't want to be is a prison. If you're in this room here and you say, "Where can I go home?" This room here becomes your prison. What's the opposite of prison? It's called freedom. And freedom is wanting to be here. It doesn't matter how austere it is. If you want to be here, you're free. If you're happy with your partner, they're not the best husband, not the worst. They're all the same. As I said, I think, this morning in KL. Husbands, they're like the difference between a Proton and a Mitsubishi. On the outside, they've got a different label, but inside, the same engine. All the same. So if you think, "I'm going to get rid of this one and buy a new one," it's exactly the same. All husbands are the same. Same with all wives, all the same. Maybe like slightly different detail on the outside. For the engine and the handling are exactly the same. But if you're happy with the one you've got, then you're free. So a lot of times suffering is not being happy where you are. And you try and change where you are instead of trying to change your attitude to life. If you can't beat suffering, join it. So I'm not going to try and change my life. I'm going to embrace it. The door of my heart is open to this moment, to my life as it is. You'll find the suffering just vanishes. It's not life that is suffering. It's the way we look at it. Even people with cancers. I've done a lot of counselling for people with cancers. It's not wanting to be here. want to get rid of it. I don't like this. I'm ashamed of this. I'm afraid of this. That's a problem. That's the suffering. Not the disease. That's nature. It's the way we look at it. If you understand that, you understand the heart of the Buddhist teachings. Can't change the world. You can change the way you look at it. Does that answer the question? Well, let's try the third one.
Yeah. What sort of dukkha is this, and how does one get out of it? You are trying to say to accept it as it is. Mm-hmm. Don't go against it.
If you can't change it, accept it. Because it's the wanting to get rid of things. A good example of this is a story which was told by the Buddha, which is in, again, the book. It's called The Story of the Demon Who Came into the Emperor's Palace. This was a story told by the Buddha 2,500 years ago, which is so applicable to many things in our modern life. It's a metaphor. Once there was an emperor who lived in a big palace. He was out on some business this day when a demon, a monster, came right into his palace. The monster was so ugly, so stinky and frightening that all the guards, the soldiers, the ministers and the servants who should be protecting the palace froze in terror, allowing this demon to go right into the throne room and sit on the emperor's chair. And at that, the people in the palace came to their senses. They, get out of here! Who do you think you are? And at those few unkind words and gestures, the demon grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more smelly, and more offensive. So they got out their swords, threatening this demon. Get out of here or we'll carve out your butt with our swords. You don't belong in here. Get out! Every unkind word, unkind deed, or even unkind thought, the demon, the monster, grew an inch bigger, more ugly, more offensive, more smelly. And this had been going on a long time when the emperor came back. By this time, the demon was huge. He took up half of the throne room. And he was so ugly, so frightening, that even Steven Spielberg, with all the resources of DreamWorks, could not manufacture, even with digital technology, anything which looked so frightening. And as for the smell, it was such a stench coming off this demon, would even make a maggot throw up. And the language was worse than you'd hear in Sydney, King's Cross, on a Saturday night after Australia lost the cricket. But the emperor was the boss because he was smart. He saw this terrible, disgusting monster in his palace. He knew exactly what to do. He said, welcome. Thank you for coming to visit me. Is there anything you need? Can I get you a drink or something to eat? In those few words of kindness, they all noticed the demon grow an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. And all the workers in the palace finally realized their mistake. They started giving kindness to this problem rather than negativity. One of the soldiers gave the monster a foot massage. Have you ever had reflexology? Oh, that felt so nice. The demon had such a big head, they gave him a neck massage. Oh, that was lovely. Well, I asked, do you want a cup of tea? We have Earl Grey, we have chamomile, it's good for your health. Someone asked him, do you want a pizza? I said, yes, we'll get monster size for the monster. And every kind act, kind word, or even kind thought, the demon grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less offensive, and less smelly. And they kept on with the kindness until that monster was the same size as when he first came in the palace. But they kept on going. They didn't stop. Soon the demon was so tiny that one more act of kindness and the demon vanished completely away. And when the Buddha told the story, he said, we call such demons anger-eating demons. They feed on anger and negativity. Much of the suffering in life comes under the category of anger-eating demons. We get angry at it. We say, get out of here, you don't belong, I don't want you. And it gets bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. You try that with your husband. You give him anger, he gets bigger, uglier, and it gets more offensive. We give him kindness when he's angry. There you go, darling, never mind. And then he gets smaller, less ugly, less offensive. Same with your wife as well. She's an anger eating demon sometimes too. And that's a beautiful story there, because many of the sufferings of life, because we give them negativity, that's what they feed on. They get worse. It's an anger-eating demon. Not everything is an anger-eating demon, but many things are. So give that strategy a chance. Instead of negativity, thank you for coming to teach me. Life. It may be tough now, but this is what I call fertilizer. If ever you tread in dog excrement, because sometimes the dogs, they do their business on the sidewalk. If you ever tread in dog excrement, dog poo, never scrape it off your shoes. Don't waste it. Take it home. And dig it under your mango tree. Because 1 year later, your mangoes will be sweeter than ever before. But when you eat that mango, please remember what you're eating. Dog excrement transformed. That's what suffering is like. When you know how to use it, it's smelly and ugly at the beginning, but it becomes very sweet at the end. If you know how to turn dog poo into a sweet mango. Okay? Does that answer your three questions?
So what you're saying is, by accepting this suffering, it'll in a way alleviate my dukkhas later on?
Yeah, it'll make you wise and compassionate. I've mentioned this to many people, because especially young people, before you find your partner in life, you get broken heart. Many times. But unless you've really had a lot of hurt in your life, you'll never know how to love. You think you may know how to love, but unless you've experienced pain and suffering, you have no idea what compassion truly is. It is in the tears, which we will shed many times in our lives, that is actually what waters the plant of wisdom and compassion. Suffering has a purpose in this life. Its purpose is to learn, to grow, to be wise, and eventually to be compassionate. Without suffering, there would be no incentive. There would be no juice of tears to make things grow. No smelly, disgusting fertilizer. This is what suffering is all about. Okay, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Venerable. Thank you very much.
Is there some more questions there? Or we run out? Oh, we've got some more. Yeah?
Venerable, my father has just passed away. But the problem is, my mother still cannot let go of it. I've tried to explain to her several times that past is the past. Life still has to go on. But she will not listen. I don't know what to do. Please guide me, Venerable.
Okay, first of all, our mothers will never listen to their sons. You can't teach your mum. You know, I'm quite a well-known monk now. There's no way I can teach my mother anything. Because, you know, she looked after me when I was that small. And so, you know, that in psychologically, that, you know, she, you know, is my, always going to be my teacher. So sons and daughters, give up. You can't teach your mother. You get someone else to do it for you. That's number one. However, there is another way of dealing with grief. And this is, again, another personal story, because my father died when I was only 16. And I love my father very, very, very much. But at his funeral, I never cried. I never cried since. I never felt sad when he died. You know why? Because I loved him so much. To understand what I mean, I give you the simile of the concert. I grew up in London. As a young man, I loved music. I used to go to all types of music, you know, from the Albert Hall to little pubs and clubs. Every type of music, from rock music, folk music, classical music to jazz, I liked the whole lot. And I got great memories. For those of you who know rock music, I remember seeing the very, very first concert of Led Zeppelin. I also remember with my brother going to a room above a pub in north of London to see this small rock group, and only six people actually turned up to watch. And I thought the band would not play, but they did anyway. The lead singer later became quite famous. It's called Rod Stewart. Those days when he's an unknown. So these are just some memories I have of these great concerts which I went to as a young man. But those of you who know London, in the evening, you know, when concerts finish, 10, 11 o'clock at night, it's always cold and miserable. And I always remember it as raining. You know, they have a word for rain in London. It's not really raining, but it's not raining. It's called drizzle. Drizzle is so gloomy and depressing. And I remember when a concert was finishing, you know, everybody would stand up, clap and shout for more. That's what you do. And the band or the orchestra would always carry on for maybe another 5 or 10 minutes. But then came the time they had to stop. They had to go home, and so did I. And at the end of every great concert, when I went out of those halls or those pubs or clubs into the cold, drizzly, wet, gloomy London night, knowing I'd probably never listen or have the opportunity to hear such great music again, not from that performer, never once did I feel sad after a great performance. I never cried at the end of concerts. When I went out of those concert halls, I felt uplifted, inspired. What a great performance that had been, and how lucky I was to have been there listening to it. And I remembered much of that music on the way home, and I remember it even now, maybe 40 years later. That's exactly how I felt when my father died. What a great concert that had been. What a magnificent performance, Father. I wouldn't have missed those 16 years for the world. I never felt sad. I felt privileged. I felt gratitude. Wow, how lucky I was to have known such a man. That's why I never cried, no more than I cry after a great concert. There's another way of looking at the end of things. Instead of looking at what's been taken away, look for what you had. The years you've known that person, rather than the years they're not going to be there for you. It's a different perspective, that's all. And it stops the tears, and instead gives this beautiful inspiration inside. It's a simile of the concert to stop the tears of grief. If you understand that, the more you love a person, the less you'll cry. Next question.
When we think negatively, negative things are attracted to us. How do we stay positive all the time?
Easy. You've got a choice. Why allow life to spoil your happiness? Again, to this premier, Dr. Jeff Gallup, that was his favorite phrase he learned from me. Because when you're in politics, sometimes the media is always looking for the worst possible interpretation of what you said or did. Especially in the West. And they're always pulling you down, saying you did the wrong thing, and it's so difficult being a leader in the West because people are always criticizing you. So I told this Dr. Gallup, the Premier, I said, look, don't allow the media to control your happiness. And it clicked in him. He said, yeah, just because they say these things, I'm not going to allow it to spoil my day. And don't allow what your wife says to control your happiness. Or your husband says, or your boss says. Your happiness is under your control. Once, or if somebody calls you a dog, that's a very terrible thing to call someone. If someone calls you a dog, what should you do? Answer, look at your bottom to see if you have a tail. If you haven't got a tail, you're not a dog. End of problem. So you don't have to allow other people to control your happiness. So you don't have to allow life to control your happiness either. You can be happy no matter what. Your attitude. Because happiness lies in the mind. It doesn't lie in the body. And your mind can be free whenever you want. So this is how to have a positive attitude. Number one, you can if you want to. And number two, you get far more success in life. You achieve your goals much more with a positive attitude than with a negative one. I already said, remember your successes, not your faults. If you want to sort of have a nice time with your partner, praise her. Tell her how beautiful she looks, how good her cooking is, how kind she is. Now lay it on as thick as you like and see the result. Oh, she'll be just so nice afterwards. Of course it is. Praise gets you everywhere. You kids, go up to your mum, as I said earlier, and say how much you love your mother and how much you respect your father. And look, father, mother, that you know, you just sacrificed so much for me. You're so, so kind, parents. I really love you. Can I have an increase in my pocket money? Of course they'll do that. Oh, he's such a nice kid. He's so kind. Yeah, go on. It's amazing that it works. If you praise other people, they become soft. Now, someone who was actually in conflict management, when you've got two partners, either in business or in life, at war, and you want to try and bring them together, you never focus on what separates them, first of all. You find something to praise them, something they have in common. And once you actually get a person's trust, you know that you know you're not being negative towards them, but you have this positive attitude towards each other. Look, I really respect you. You're a really wonderful wife. You've been so kind. But you know one thing about your cooking. Now, if you really praise a person and put the points of discussion in context, there's no argument anymore. People listen because they know that you're really loving and respecting them. The positive attitude is the only way which solves problems in the world. If you're so negative, you say the Palestinians and the Israelis, there's no way they can ever get together. Then there never will be any way. If you think they're irreconcilable, then they will. If that's all you're looking at, what separates them, what the difference is, there's no way you can get any solution. You look what they've got in common. Now, what do they really like? And can the Palestinian respect the Israeli Jew? Can the Israeli Jew respect the Palestinian Muslim? If they can do that first, then there can be the start of solutions. You have to have that respect, first of all. Seeing the good in another person. A positive view. Without that, there's no solution. So sometimes we do that because we have to. The alternative is too terrible.
Similar questions. How can I help a family member who is most unskillful? Or how do you deal with a person who has committed his wrongdoings and yet refused to abandon them? Please advise.
Okay, you have to, if they've admitted their wrongdoings, but they will not sort of remedy them, stop looking at their wrongdoings, look at their right doings. Focus more on those. Because you can, in a garden, you can either water the flowers or you water the weeds. If you water the weeds, those are the ones which grow. If you water the flowers grow. So if you give positive reinforcement to that family member's good qualities, say, look, I really appreciate, you know, the good stuff you do, whatever it is, you know, that, you know, you drove me to the talk this evening. Thank you so much. It's very kind of you to do that. You even sometimes go over the top in your praise. And that person become encouraged enough, they want to do that again. They say, oh, any time, next time, please let me know. They really want to help you because we all like to be praised, to be loved, to be respected. So your family member, focus on their good qualities. Reinforce those with praise, talking about the good qualities. And you find those good qualities will grow. Eventually the flowers grow so much they choke out the weeds. But if you focus on their faults, keep reminding them of their faults, of the terrible things they've done, they'll keep repeating those bad faults again and again and again. Sometimes you have to focus on the other stuff. And then the bad things disappear. It's a wonderful way of working. I learned this in educational psychology. Two ways of teaching. One is called positive reinforcement, the other is negative reinforcement. Negative reinforcement means when you make a mistake, you get the cane or you get some punishment. And that's the way I think many of us learn to school. Positive reinforcement, when you make a mistake, forgiven straight away, but you do something good, you do well, you get praise, you get rewards. Every experiment done in psychology has proved again and again and again, positive reinforcement works so much better than negative reinforcement. And that's teaching children. If you want to teach your husband positive reinforcement, if he does the right thing, smother him with kisses, hugs, give him the best meal you can possibly make for him. Oh, thank you so much, husband, for coming home on time today. Whatever it is. If you give positive reinforcement, it really works. When I was in US about 13 months ago, I heard of this man who was making a fortune using positive reinforcement to train people's pets. Because, you know, in New York or in San Fran, if you've got like a cat or a dog in your apartment, you can't allow the cat or the dog to urinate or excrete, you know, on your carpet or on your sort of furniture. So you've got to try and train your pet to do its business outside. And this guy was training pets to do their toilet outside using positive reinforcement. They paid this guy or one of his workers a sum of money. He said, within 3 days, I guarantee your pet will only do his business outside. And how he did that, he would take the pet out and wait. And when the cat or when the dog weed on the tree or pooed in the grass, this man would jump up and down for joy, do cartwheels and sing a happy song. And the little dog would see he'd made this human being really happy. And he'd only do his business outside from that time on. It worked. And the guy was making a fortune. Positive reinforcement even works for animals. It works for kids as well. If your kid does really well at school, just shower him with praise. Not just for one day, day after day after day. If he does well, reinforce it with rewards. You get much further in changing a person's behavior with rewards than you do with punishments. Positive reinforcement, it works. However, I was also told that that company was running into a bit of trouble later on. Because sometimes they'd be at home watching the TV with their dog just sitting quite quietly, maybe on the couch. And sometimes they'd be watching football. And sometimes their team would score a try. They'd go, "Hey!" You know what the dog would do. Okay, next question.
Final question. How are merits transferred or shared with others, either alive or deceased?
Okay, how do you share merits? First of all, with those who are deceased. What that really means is that we want to try and encourage the people who are dead to rejoice in our goodness. How that works is as follows. This was a story in the Melbourne Age one weekend, which somebody cut out and sent to me. There was a veterinary surgeon in Melbourne, who had finished work on a Friday afternoon and was going into the countryside of Victoria, maybe a short distance of 2 hours drive, for a weekend party with his friends. So in the car alone, driving down the motorway, when halfway on the journey he was overcome by such strong emotions, he started crying. He had to pull to the side of the road. And for no apparent reason, he wept for about 15 minutes. He was emotionally overcome. And the strange thing was, he did not know why. Number one, he was a man. Why start crying? But it was so bad, he had to stop driving. And when he pulled himself together and wiped his tears away, he carried on in the journey. When he got to the home of his friend where he'd spend the weekend, there was a message waiting for him. His dog had been run over by a car at precisely the moment he had this strong emotion of grief. His dog was in Melbourne, maybe about 100 kilometres away when this happened. But he felt at that moment something had gone wrong. Maybe you've had those experiences. You may have a son or a daughter, say in London or New York. They have an accident. You know something's wrong, especially if you're the mother or even the father. How does that work? Because that's a relation of yours, a loved one, there is a contact there. And that contact goes across space. You don't need to SMS or email that something's wrong, you know inside. That's the mechanism which is used when we transfer merits to our loved departed ones. When a person has died, that contact is still there. Just by thinking of them that way, focusing on them, you make that connection. Having made that connection, what you do is saying, look, the merits, the goodness, the charity, the kindness, whatever I've done today, I'm doing that in your memory. Because of you. As an expression of my love. Because you know how we express love? We express love by giving things. You know, you get engaged, you give your loved one gifts. On birthdays and Valentine's days, you give gifts to your loved ones. That's how we express our love, by giving. And by doing this charity, you're saying, I still love you. I care for you. And I'm doing this charity for you. May you rejoice in this. And because you are doing something good and thinking of them, just like something wrong happens, you feel bad. Something wrong happens to your loved one in New York, you feel bad now. If something good happens to them, you feel good. If you do something good now, your departed loved ones will feel good. You transferred the karma. You transferred the merits. Your goodness done here has made them happy in whatever realm they're in. That's how it works. That's the physics of it. But to be able to work, you've really got to think of them, make that connection. They have to really be a loved one or someone you really know very well. If it's a person who's too distant from you, sometimes it doesn't work. Or if it's someone, it may be your father, but he's died 20, 30 years ago, sometimes that's again too distant. It may not work. But if it's someone who's especially recently died, then of course that works. Or even if they're still alive, you've got the connection there, you think of them, and they know you're thinking of them. I've done that experiment many times when I've taught retreats. Usually at the end of the retreat, when people have been meditating for a long time, and they've got pretty powerful minds, I lead them through a metta meditation, loving kindness meditation. At a certain time I say, now, say, think of your husband. You know, you may be, say, in Penang, your husband's in KL. Think of them and spread lots of kindness, goodwill, share the merits with them. And do it as strongly as you can. And then after they've finished, I note down the time. That was done at 3:20. When you go home, ask your husband, what were you doing at 3:20 that day? And it's amazing how many people give me phone calls. It worked, it worked. At 3:20, they said, strange you should ask that, I was thinking about you. I was so happy. You do make those connections. You can try it out yourself if you want. A loved one who's maybe in hospital, suffering. Really focus your mind. Share the goodness, the good karma, the merits, loving kindness, whatever. Next time you see them, ask them at that particular time, what were you doing? You'll be surprised how many times, not all the time, but sometimes, many times, well, you know, I was just having an injection, but then I thought of you and it didn't hurt. It does work. I've seen it many times. And that's how it works. So, thank you for listening today. And thank you for contributing to the retreat center so Mr. George W. Bush can go there one day and stop all the wars. Okay. Share merits?
Yeah, Bhante.
Okay, we can share merits now. But when you're sharing merits, think of somebody, especially if it's a deceased relation or somebody who really needs it. This time maybe focus on one person who is saying this. And all the goodness and kindness is for your well-being and health. And I'll say the words, Yi Dang Mei, you can say them with me. But also remember to think about this loved one. Yi Dang Mei Nya Ti Nang Ho Tu Sukhita Hon Tu Ya Tayo Yi Dang Mei Nya Ti Nang Ho Tu Sukhita hon tu yata yo idamme nyati nang ho tu Sukhita hon tu yata yo. Very good. Sadhu,
sadhu, sadhu.
Very good.
Ladies and gentlemen, we would like to apologize. Due to time constraint, we couldn't take all questions. Sorry. Venerable, the audience has indicated in an impressive manner its appreciation of your eloquent and entertaining talk by their total attentiveness. And it was thought-provoking too. I believe your message has made a deep impression upon our consciousness. We thank you, Venerable, for that graciousness, that friendliness of manner which has given so much charm to every moment of your presence with us. Thank you once again for sharing the Buddha Dharma with us. We are truly blessed in Ipoh. We, the Buddhist fraternity in Ipoh, are grateful for you, to you, for coming all the way from Perth, Australia, to share your joy and happiness with you. Maha Sadhu, Venerable. On behalf of the organizing committee, I would like to wish Venerable Achan good health and long life always. May you continue to teach and share the Dharma with us and open the doors in our hearts to experience joy and happiness. May the Jhana Growth Meditation Retreat Center project be a success and benefit as many meditators as possible. The organizing committee would also like to express our gratitude to Top Vision Events Adrian Berhad for sponsoring light and sound equipment, video and audio recording, as well as the backdrop design and production. Thank you, Top Vision Events in Jalan Berhad. To all our sponsors for the hall, rental, posters, flyers, Dhamma books and this, Sadhu for your generosity. All donations given tonight will be channeled to Venerable Achan Brahm's Retreat Centre in Perth, Australia. May the blessings of the Triple Gem be with you, with all the donors and sponsors, and everyone who have, one way or another, assisted in Venerable Achan's stay in Ipoh. May all donors, sponsors and supporters be blessed with Ayu Wanno Sukang Balang Panya, long life, good complexion, happiness, strength and wisdom. Last but not least, I would like to thank each and everyone present for coming to this evening talk. Sadhu. Uncles, aunties, brothers, sisters, ladies and gentlemen, may the Triple Gem bless and protect us and our loved ones tonight. May we be free from harm and danger. May we overcome our difficulties. May we always meet with success. May we be blessed with good health, strength, peace and happiness. May our parents, brothers, sisters, teachers, friends, relatives be well and happy. May they be free from harm and danger. May the Buddha Dharma Sangha bless and protect you. We would like to share the merits we have gathered today as well as in the past with the Devas. May they rejoice in these merits and keep an eye on us and our loved ones. We would also like to transfer the merits to our departed relatives and friends. Wherever they are, may they be free from suffering and be happy. Let those who are in misery be free from misery. Let those who are in fear, agony and insecure be free from fear, agony and insecurity. Let those who are in sorrow be free from sorrow. Let all living beings be free from misery, fear and sorrow. Good night.
Good night. Good night.
There is one announcement. Venerable Pasano is a senior Western monk, a disciple of Venerable Achan Cha. He will be here in Ipoh on Friday, 2nd March 2007. For details, if you are interested to attend this talk, you could find out from the counter, okay, for the venue. Thank you and good night. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.